So we've been looking at this case, case 32 from the Book of Serenity, and the pointer I mentioned before, the pointer to the case, says, the ocean is the world of dragons, disappearing and appearing. They sport serenely. The sky is the home of cranes. They fly and call freely. There's some more to the pointer, but that's the part I want to talk about. Because this part refers to the stage of the person. So that's what Yangshan's reply to the monk when he said he didn't see any existence. He said it was, that was right for the stage of faith, but not yet for the stage of person. So the stage of person is this, these august teachers. They're the example of the stage of the person. Guishan and Yangshan themselves are like dragons and cranes. They sport freely, they call freely. Well, they sport serenely, it says. It sports serenely. A dragon sports serenely, apparently. Mm-hmm. And a crane calls freely. We have cranes, you know, here, right near us. You should go see them. They're here this time of year. And they definitely call freely and loudly and in numbers. It's quite a phenomena to watch the cranes fly in and out of our valley here. But in this case, we don't know. These are some other kinds of cranes that they're probably talking about. But the point is that the point I'd like to make is that though Yangshan and Guishan and these revered teachers, these dedicated people of the way sport and call freely, they do so within conditions. The dragon lives in the ocean, and the crane lives in land and sky. The point I'd like to make is that at this stage of the person who always has problems with his robe, at the stage of this person, there is freedom, but there's freedom within conditions. It's not freedom from conditions. It's not freedom outside of conditions. It's freedom within conditions of earth and sky, ocean and sky in this case. They are lofty beings, Yangshan and Guishan, but they're immersed in their element, just like all of us are. Of a particular importance to us. We're all immersed in karmic consciousness, right? And so we have this condition that we are studying freedom within. We're studying freedom within a condition called karmic consciousness. That's actually our environment. That's the environment of human beings. Or it's one way of talking about the environment of human beings. So, to further illustrate this point, I remembered a story about our great founder of the Soto Zen school in China, Dungshan Liangji. And a monk asked Dungshan famously, everybody knows this story, famously asked Dungshan, where can I go to avoid hot and cold? And Dungshan's reply was, when it's hot, heat kills the monk. When it's cold, cold kills the monk. Or sometimes we hear that, I think the first time I heard this story was, when it's hot, be a hot Buddha. When it's cold, be a cold Buddha. So this points to this same point that I want to make, that we are working within conditions, we are responding to conditions, and we are encouraged to find our freedom. The freedom to sport and call freely within those conditions, within the conditions that we find ourselves, and within our own body and mind, or karmic consciousness, if you like. As Suzuki Roshi said, when you become you, Zen becomes Zen. And this is, again, pointing to this phenomena that you become you within conditions, not apart from conditions. The most precious thing is to be present in all circumstances in the midst of our habitual life, in the midst of this consciousness that's shaped in the particular way that it's shaped. And it's different for all of us. Everyone here has a unique set of conditions that they're working. Much in common, but we all have our stuff. We all have our points of difficulty and our points of ease. It's possible, that we find ourselves in conditions that we don't like, and we try to change those conditions, and that's something we do, that's definitely something we do. But it is childish to always point to conditions and say, well, it's the conditions. If only for the conditions. If only for these conditions can change, then, I would be happy, then I would be satisfied, blah, blah, blah. As we know, this is a practice in which we first point to ourselves, not to the conditions. We may do something about the conditions, but what's really close is our response. That's what we're looking at most closely in practice. We have to turn around and study ourselves. So I would propose that the hardest thing that a person can do is to be authentic. To not be posturing, but to try to be present in the world, not being more than you are, or not diminishing yourself, just being you, being willing to be you, and part of that is standing up for yourself. And part of that is giving in to the needs of others. And that's the dance. That's the discernment. That's where the rubber meets the road, as they say. So there's this other story. Somehow Dongshan came to mind again. And in this other story is about the time when Dongshan, having been with his teacher Yunyan for many years, decided it was time, or maybe they, I think they mutually decided that it was time for Dongshan to go off and to his own mountain, as they say, you know, to start his own place of practice. So they had a meeting, and Dongshan said, after you know, I go away, and when people ask me about you, Yunyan, how should I respond? What should I say? And Yunyan was, according to the story, quiet for a bit. And he said, just this person. And in that time, that phrase, just this person, was a way of that a person who was brought before a magistrate was expected to confess their guilt. They were supposed to say, if they were entering a guilty plea, as it were, the right words were just this person. So Yunyan, using that phrase in that instance, was a confession. And what I hear him saying is that I don't try to be more than I am. I don't try to be less than I am. I have, you know, this much emotionality and this much wisdom. I have this much distraction. I have this much concentration. My dedication is to being just who I am, without posturing, without trying to be more, and also without, you know, shrinking violet kind of presentation. So just this person. So I think now this is the sixth day of Sesshin, such as we've had, a kind of Sesshin that's a hybrid Sesshin, but it's the sixth day, or the seventh day. Anyway, it's we're almost, you know, we're getting there, you know. And I think that we've been listening to this story for quite a while, and I think maybe we're getting, you know, some sense of what's being got at here in this story. And there is, and the commentary to this case is quite explicit. You know, a lot of times the commentary is as hard to understand as the case, but in this case, the commentary is very explicit. It's very, and just basically telling you what, well, at least what Wang Song thinks they were talking about in that dialogue. And so Wansong quotes another teacher in the case who says, he talks about the state of the person, right? So, because not yet right for the state of the person. So here's a quote right about the state of the person. The state of the person, or state of person, is fundamentally empty. That's the starting place. Fundamentally empty. Body and mind are without attachment. Gain and loss are cleared away. Body and mind are without attachment. Gain and loss are cleared away. The hidden, mysterious path is far beyond discrimination. As for the absolute word, attempt to discuss it and you fail. So, so you know, Emily Dickinson says, tell the whole truth, but tell it on the slant. I'm not really good at that, I have to confess. I'm not really good at telling it on the slant. But actually, Wansong is not really telling it on the slant either, so I feel sort of absolved. I think it's okay. But anyway, so not on the slant. You know, what we've been talking about is this insight into emptiness is a stage of faith, and that insight is the basis of the stage of the person. That's the underpinning of the stage of the person. And this, you know, this quote pretty much says this: the state of the person is fundamentally empty. Body and mind are without attachment. Gain and loss are cleared away. So, supposed to be one more page. Yes, it is. And there's one more point that I wanted to make, and it's a point I've made before. it comes from this book called Losing Ourselves by Jay Garfield. And I spent a whole one day sitting talking about this, but I just want to remind that he, in this book, he makes a strong argument. He with another philosopher. This is what philosophers do. You know, they tell what the other philosopher has said, and then they say why all that they said is off the beam. You know, and that makes their argument. You know, and this is what philosophers like to do, and that's actually just what they do. That's their thing. So he does. He mentions this other philosopher whose name I've forgotten, Slosson or something, I think maybe, who argues for the existence of a self, and Garfield systematically destroys his argument, or at least according to him, he does. But to me, this was not the most interesting part of this book. The interesting part of this book was that he proposed an alternative to the idea or the concept, the conception of a self. In other words, he wasn't just pulling the rug out from under the self. He actually had something, you know, philosophically to postulate or to offer in the alternative. As you know, in Buddhism, what the mistake that we are told we make is that we have five skandhas, And that's what we, you know, that's the basis, and that we make the mistake of grasping them as a self, grasping form, feelings, perceptions, formations, and consciousness as a self. So, in any case, Garfield says, "Well, here's another." Way of looking at this. How do we relate to this? And he says to know this, that to know this is to know a person who is known by his or her activity and commitments. To know this person is to know a person who's known by their activity and commitments. And I found this a very helpful way, not necessarily of, you know, having a philosophical argument with myself about the self. That's not how I've used it. I've used it as, well, yeah, how do I wish to be known to myself and others? By what activity and commitments do I wish to be known to myself and to others? And I found this very helpful. And you can use it in the sense of looking at the six paramitas by what activities and commitments do I wish to be known in relationship to my generosity? By what activities and commitments do I wish to be known on the basis of my morality? My patience, my virya, energy. How do I wish to be known to myself as regards my meditation? Probably others can't know me, you know, by my meditation, but I can know myself by my meditation. I can know how I relate to myself in Zazen. You know, I can know how I treat myself. I can know what my activity is in Zazen, what my commitment is to Zazen. And finally, you know, again, for wisdom, by what activities and commitments should others and myself know this through how I manifest wisdom, how I treat people, how I react to unpleasant phenomena, and so forth. So I found this idea of a person, and this is I guess you'd say, not within the case. But this was, you know, but expanding the viewpoint to take in this modern presentation about a person, and you know, we are talking about someone who, I mean, within the case, we're talking about, you know, a big person, right? We're talking about a generous person who has cultivated big mind for a long time, these great teachers. So I think there's some correspondence, you know, between the stage of the faith, the stage of a person, and this this modern presentation. So, how do I wish to be known to this person right here? And you know, how do I relate to others who are have either similar values or don't have similar values? I've always thought that, you know, this life of practice is about cleaning up your act. That's part of it, at least. So a question like, how do I wish to be known through my activities and commitments? Pretty helpful, actually, for checking yourself out. And seeing where you fall short with compassion for those shortcomings, and seeing where you succeed, and then also not getting caught in that, you know, not getting caught in your attainments or successes or great outcomes. Threading the needle all the time with care and compassion for ourselves and others. So I didn't take any questions yesterday. That's kind of I was trying that out because that's a traditional session form. In a long session, in any case, and I was trying it out for our short session. I don't know, but in any case, I want to open it up to your comments. We haven't had any so far, and maybe in a sort of short session that was rude or something. But in any case, I'm happy to have some conversation or questions now. Kenny, we're going to do the...
Yesterday, I think you talked about something about one flavor. One taste.
Oh yeah, one taste. Mm-hmm.
So yesterday I was thinking about the whole enchilada. Mm. And then I was thinking, today I'm just going to accept good, bad, everything. It's one soup. Everything gets cut up and turned into this soup. Maybe it has one flavor. So then, at the end, during Zazen, you said something about tasting the universe, and maybe I had that wrong. So I was freaked out. I was like, whoa, Jim's like reading my mind, you know. I just came up with this idea. So it might be just in resonance with what you said about the one taste. So that was my stroke of insight.
Excellent.
Thanks.
I think I said in Zazen, I said, swallow the whole universe. Yeah. And it's, you know, it's related to the one taste. And since I really should tell it on the slant sometimes, I don't think I should say any more. But good. I mean, you know, I like that I like that I was reading your mind. Sarah.
Jim, I love that Emily Dickinson poem, but I'd like to talk a little bit about the rest of it. It's tell it on the slant, but then I don't know, remember the exact thing, but it's the children can't stand or are afraid of the sound of the thunder.
Yeah.
And that reminds me of it's coming back to Zazen and just this person. And the effect of Zazen in the when you can settle like this in a long retreat and let go of and just be in the air, in the room. It's out of that comes the ability to tell it on the slant, because you don't have to thunder and give everybody your opinion right up front and tell them, no, you're doing it wrong. You have, because you're just there, you can have some relationship and understanding of first about what's going on with this person or this other being or this other situation that's causing it to be frightened by the thunder. And instead of thundering more, you know, what do you do to tell it on the slant that this thunder are these beautiful clouds talking to each other, echoing back and forth? And isn't it wonderful to be here in the middle of this echo chamber?
Well, in our day and age, I will say we certainly know something about the thunder. We have a lot of people thundering around in this world, telling us thunderous things. So to have some time to receive the truth gently and calmly and quietly together is truly wonderful. I was also thinking, this group is kind of getting mature. I mean, this group kind of knows how to do sesshin. I mean, I was impressed by you all. I was impressed by the way you're doing things and the way you're being in this sesshin. It's wonderful to see that, to see kind of us doing sesshin together with sesshin mind. You know, that kind of care for the environment. Oscar?
Thanks for the talk, Jim. I don't know about slant or not, but I thought it was, seems, well, thank you. So I have two questions about the case. I'm interested in the dialogue between Geshe Wishan and Yangshan, the way they're relating to each other. It starts out with a very ordinary conversation question, where are you from? And very quickly—
That's a dialogue between the monk, not Guishan.
Excuse me.
Between the monk and Yangshan.
Thank you, correct. Very quickly, it morphs into sort of a transcendent exploration. And I wonder what you think about when that happened. Did Yangshan ask that question probingly because he knew that monk? Or did it start out that way? Or what, you know? I'm interested in like that relationship between teacher and monk and the way they quickly speak into sort of quickly slip into a meta discussion, if you will.
Yeah, I think the case is like really compressed, you know, and it like it's a distillation, and there's a lot that we don't see, and this is just a Reader's Digest, but that's not right either. It's like what do they put at the beginning of a when you do your thesis,
the abstract.
This is like the abstract, right? And so there's a lot left out. And, you know, this could be the distillation of many conversations that they had. And it just brings out the most salient issues. That's what I think. It's really just the salient core stuff.
Can I follow up with us another similar question? At the end, the monk said, well, don't you have a particular way of teaching?
Mm.
And I think he's saying, well, okay, thanks for that advice, but now what do I do? And I think probably the same observation, there's a lot of backstory there. But do you have any thoughts about that?
That's my talk tomorrow. So I can't give them to you now.
Not even on this land? Okay.
No, I can talk about it.
No coming attraction.
Well, yeah, this is, it's going to be hard to come up with a new talk for tomorrow. So, but
I can wait.
Wait.
Okay.
I'm sure there's other questions. And I will answer that question tomorrow.
So I was curious about who is the writer that you mentioned?
Oh, Jay Garfield.
Mm-hmm. Jay Garfield.
Mm-hmm.
And comparing that to the case. And mm-hmm. so the foundation of the prison is swallowing the whole universe, right? It's that emptiness that you said is the foundation of the prison. And out of that, I'm asking you personally,
mm-hmm.
is that the source of your commitment that you express through your actions?
I personally, you're asking me that. And I would say, yes, it is. That's the foundation it's like somebody I was recently talking to who did some intensive practice said that one of the encouragements that she gives to herself is that she remembers a certain time of practice where everything was clear, where everything was just as empty as empty could be, and uses that as a kind of, you know, that memory, even though she may not be you know, in that place right now and may even have a hard time accessing that place today, but nevertheless, it's a basis. It's a touchstone. You have to be careful about that kind of thing, because that kind of thing is, well, then, you know, are you always trying to get back there? You know, are you trying to get back to that experience? And think, well, if I don't have that experience, it's not authentic practice. That's where you have to be careful with that kind of thing. Nevertheless, in the same way, to answer for myself, I rely on experiences similar experiences, which tell me in my life today what is possible, and also it just informs inform, I feel like, and as I mentioned before, I feel like this informs my life in ways that I can't see, that aren't, you know, it's just underpinning. Yeah, that's what I feel like. I think probably you have some similar type of experiences.
Sometimes.
So would it make sense to think of those two stages as one coming after the other? The stage of empty illumination, if I remember it,
mm-hmm.
and that stage of a person. And I was just wondering what would be the zero stage, so just the stage of normal, deluded human being?
Oh, deluded human being?
Mm.
Well, to the first part of your question, I would say I would be hesitant to say one after the other. I would be sort of like there's a negotiation going on. There's a conversation going on there right within that phrase, they're really trying to mutually support each other. You know, the stage of the person and the stage of faith are working together in support of the deluded person. So they're really trying to help the deluded person. You know, that it's all about actually helping the deluded person. And lifting up the little deluded person out of their delusion, and you know, I think of Blake or that picture. He's looking, you know, ever seen that? He's looking out into the universe. William Blake. There's some graphic, you know. Anyway, yeah. That's what I would say.
Thank you so much, Jim. And thank you for talking. One last thing I want to mention, which is what Kenny said about the... I think what you said during the last period was very on point. Because I felt similar way too. I was trying to take in just everything that's happening, regardless of how I feel or what I think about it. And when you said just gulping it all down and being happy about it. That was something that resonated very well.
Mm.
Thank you so much.
Karen?
My question is about karmic consciousness. Maybe I don't really understand what it is, but what I have thought about karma is, I mean, maybe it just means awareness of karma, of my karma, and so that I don't just keep repeating things that I don't want to, or I don't value, or aren't helpful, and I can cultivate more wholesome activity that, well, I don't like the word good karma, but anyway, so that I don't just unconsciously repeat karma that is harmful to myself or others.
Mm-hmm.
So when you were talking about karmic consciousness, I guess I wasn't really sure what that, how you were referring, what you were referring.
Okay, well, I can clarify that. There was a quote in the talk yesterday, I think, from the sixth ancestor, and he said he was talking about not seeing good and bad people. That in the state of awareness that he was recommending, that he was describing, no good and bad people were seen. Karmic consciousness is seeing good and bad people. And and all other examples of like that. That's what our normal is a normal situation, unfortunately. Likes and dislikes and so forth, picking and choosing, good people and bad people. And that's the activity of karmic consciousness. It's that activity. And it's at this moment, I feel a sadness for this world. I feel a sadness for this world because there's so much of that. There's so much of that unexamined karmic consciousness. And that's a source of suffering. It's a source of my suffering. And it's a source for the suffering of the world. And what we do here is so important. Because we're studying karmic consciousness. We're studying the way we chop up the world into good and bad, right and wrong, good people and bad people. Let's study this for the sake of the world. Let's study it.
Experiences of emptiness, and for me it verges into, it can become really beautiful, like you mentioned the Blake painting, like so rich and sublime and beautiful, but it can also become empty and one flavor and kind of nihilistic. And I feel like for me, I'm always kind of treading that line. So that I'm always kind of treading that line of emptiness becoming infinitely rich and emptiness becoming like a single point of nothing. I guess my question within that is, am I using this, is this concept the same as what you're talking about when you talk about emptiness?
Well, there's an understanding of emptiness that's nihilistic. Is that kind of the one extreme that you're talking about? That nothing, I don't know.
I don't know if it's an extreme. I mean, I'm just saying, like, when I'm sitting and I'm trying and I'm focusing on emptiness, it can either become very expansive or super contracted. Like, it can become like nothing almost, or it can become, you know, everything, kind of. Mm. And it's just like, I feel like I have to it's a tension that I have to negotiate, or, you know. Mm. And I don't know, just wondered if that was kind of how you experienced it. Mm.
I was trying to remember of the quote I read from the case about when Yongshan was sitting in front of the hall, and he called it this is and Guishan. He was telling Guishan about this experience, and then Guishan said this is just melting illumination. I thought that was I never heard of it expressed that way, melting illumination. So there's a sense there of a great sameness, a great one taste, or you know, melt everything, you know, because the insight that I'm you know, based on my practice, it is along the lines of what Alexei was saying, of that was pretty much that you know, everything is equally accepted, everything is equally brought in, and so it's melting, everything melting together, you know, kind of in one illumination, where you know, then discrimination of different things is not so much seen right then. And you know, this is a point I was going to make, and maybe it's an important point to make. You know, when the monk says he doesn't see any existence at all, it doesn't mean that there isn't any existence. This is an important point. It just means at that time. So at that time, he didn't see. I think he says that. He says, right then. When I turn back the mind to think of the mind that thinks, right then, I don't see any existence at all. I feel like I am not getting to your. I'm not able to answer your question about the expansion and the contraction. Is the contraction painful or dark? Yes, kind of.
It's dismal.
Dismal.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Kind of like when you said one flavor. To me, everything being one flavor, it's dismal. Whereas, like, actually, I remember a meditation teacher at a yoga studio once said something about people experiencing all the flavors of life. And I love that because, you know, I could see, like, all the richness of all the flavors. And it's, anyway, so, yeah, it's the opposite of that. The contraction is just, it's like nothingness. I guess it's,
well, the emptiness, as I understand the emptiness in our school, at least in this sense that it's talked about, is more related to fullness than nothingness. It's more related to taking everything in, not discriminating, but not annihilating anything either, you know. We're not in the business of annihilating difference, but we're in the business of taking everything in as it is, and you know, the Sixth Sense, Sir also said when he was talking, he said, you know, don't become attached to emptiness. He was saying, don't become attached. He said, this is the most important thing. He said, the most important thing is not to become attached to emptiness. And at the end of that quote, he said, don't let emptiness become mere blankness. He said, don't let it become mere blankness. So I don't know if any of that helps, but don't be afraid of emptiness, I would say also. You know, don't be afraid of your experience. Don't fear your experience. Just if it becomes like dark and dismal, then just let it be dark and dismal. It'll change. It'll be different later, but, you know, you don't have to drill down on dark and dismal. I wouldn't recommend that. But if dark and dismal comes, yeah, let dark and dismal come. And if you know, melting illumination comes, let melting illumination come. Lisa.
What Malia was saying just reminded me of my experience, which is, it gets really loud anymore.
Well, it's because you're by the speaker. That's why.
But if you even talk really slightly. Okay. What I experience sometimes is a neutrality when I'm sitting that reminds me in some ways of part of what Leah is saying. Maybe it's a different experience. And it feels kind of impersonal. Like I feel like I'm experiencing myself in a more impersonal way than I usually do. But that actually feels helpful. Like I feel like I get something from that. But it also doesn't feel like a fullness. And sometimes I think, yeah, I need to connect this with something else. There is a little bit of that flatness that Malia was talking about. It's just common.
Thank you for your comment. Go ahead, Shalem, and then we'll go to Matthew.
Hello.
Wow.
So I don't have a question, but I just want to say to be in the Shishin for me this time has been, speaking of being open and contracted, it's been difficult, actually. And then I get up to walk, and I just start laughing because it's like, but of course it's difficult. And then being in Sangha, being here, it's like being in a bubble. This container is so protective. When I go out, like I was in Georgia, and to me, that's when the practice kicks in, is to be in a place where everybody is Christian, and Jesus means everything. And, you know, how to be in that kind of a situation is what's very interesting to me. Or seeing people who are, you know, like when I left last night and drove home, I'm in the warmth of my car, pray I don't break down. I get to my house, I go in, there's a warm bed. You know, how do I bring, you know, I want that for everybody, for everyone. And when I see a population of people that in my mind, who might be lesser than, who might not have as much, it really touches, it really shows me where my compassion lies. And a lot of times I'm like, oh, I just really need to work on my compassion around this. So, you know, I just want to thank everybody for being here, and it's been great. It's been tough, but it's also been wonderful. So I just want to say that.
Thank you very much. I think one of the hard things for us who, you know, have the privilege of this kind of experience we wish this mind, this peace, this study of karmic consciousness, we wish this for everybody, and we have so much evidence that everybody isn't getting the benefit of that, this life and this teaching, and but we had a very difficult situation yesterday morning with someone here who came very early and was clearly not, you know, in his right mind, and was angry with us, and we tried to give him a little bit of help, but we were in an awkward situation since you all were coming, and Kenny did a, you know, really masterful job of talking to him, and but he stood outside and cursed at us for a while, and because although we did let him use the bathroom and we did give him a bottle of water, but we said you know, you can't stay here, we have an event, you know, that's happening. Now, I guess the alternative would, we could have just dropped everything and said, we need to take care of this person. And that would have been a reasonable alternative. But I felt my obligation was to you who were coming. And I think Kenny felt the same way. And we asked the person repeatedly to leave. And finally, he did leave, and but not without cursing us in a way that was pretty hurtful, you know. And he was actually using racial language to attack us, and so that was pretty painful. And I felt, you know, I felt like a failure, really, to him, I was definitely a failure. There was no doubt about it. I was a complete and utter failure. And I did nothing. I mean, this is the minimal that we could do, you know, for him. We let him use the bathroom, as I said, and we let him, gave him a bottle of water, but we couldn't. Hey, you wanted an ambulance, that's right. Well, we called the police, but they...
We called the ambulance, and then it became a police thing.
Oh, I see. Anyway, it's... I mean, I just want to support your... The things that you were seeing are things we all see, you know. We all see these things, and we... It's really... You know, part of our situation here. let's see. I think. Oh, Matthew.
There are many flavors out there, and we are given an opportunity to taste some of them. And we have to take. We should taste them, and then we let them go, because it's always melting.
Thank you. We're getting toward the witching hour here, where we're going to have noon service. So, but go ahead, Dave.
I feel
a lot of stuff to think about here. Going back to the melting illumination, when something melts, it changes form. It changes its state of existence. So melting illumination, if illumination is, say, another word for enlightenment, awakening, so our enlightenment, our awakening, changes shape and form. Is that one way to look at this? That could be a whole other talk.
This is part of the mystery, I would say. This is part of the mystery. I can't really offer anything, I don't think.
That's cool. Thank you.